The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 24, 2016. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everyone. It's good to be back. This morning, I'd like to offer some Buddhist reflections on our ecological situation. And I'd like to start by talking a bit about the ecological crisis and then later on shifting more to how Buddhism, I think, can help us understand the causes or the roots, and hopefully also help us give us some ideas about how to respond to it. 2 weekends ago, I was at Dartmouth College for a 2-day seminar on spirituality and climate change. You know, this concept is growing. And then just 2 days ago, and this is what brings me to the area, I was at Carleton College in Northfield. It's my alma mater, and there's a strong movement there among students, alumni, and some faculty to divest from fossil fuels. We're trying to pressure the trustees to withdraw the investments in fossil fuel companies. So the issue of climate change or global warming is certainly on the minds of many of us. But here's my first question. What if climate change is not the real problem? Of course, it's a problem. It's a very serious and urgent one that requires us to do the best we can to respond to it. But what if it's not the problem in the sense that it's really just the tip of the iceberg, or even maybe we could say a symptom of something deeper, something more profoundly wrong. Regarding climate change itself, I don't want to say very much except maybe summarize quickly 3 points that I think we already know. Number one, it's the greatest crisis, the greatest challenge of our time, the greatest moral issue of our time, not just technological or economic, but moral issue of our time, given the question of what kind of world we're going to be leaving for future generations, right? In fact, it may well be the greatest crisis that humanity has ever faced. Secondly, what's really interesting about it is that it's something that we're doing to ourselves. I mean, it's not something that's being imposed on us like some meteorite from outer space or volcanic eruption. We're doing it as a species to ourselves. Of course, some people are more responsible than others. But nonetheless, we can't blame anyone else for what's going on, right? I remember Pogo, the old cartoon Pogo during the Vietnam War. We have met the enemy, and it is us. I wonder how we would respond if alien spaceships appeared and started pumping carbon dioxide and methane gas into the atmosphere. I think humanity would unite pretty quickly to fight against that. But because we're doing it to ourselves, it's that much more difficult to get a handle on it. And of course, some people are more responsible than others. I'm not denying that, but we can't really point the finger elsewhere. And thirdly, our response to climate change is not completely negligible, but nonetheless, I think most people would agree it's far from enough. Which raises the really interesting question, why is that? Why haven't we been able? I mean, given that we've known about this for several decades now, what is it that makes us, that stops us from responding in the ways that we need to do so? But here's my first point. All three of those points apply not just to climate change or global warming, they apply to a much larger ecological crisis. And in a way, we all know this, but it needs to be emphasized because otherwise we might think that, you know, if we can just quickly switch to renewable sources of energy, that'll solve the problem and we can go on as we have been. And I think what the ecological crisis is, it shows us pretty quickly that it's not that simple, that in a way what we're experiencing is a symptom of something far deeper, a sign of something deeper with really enormous implications for our whole civilization, right? For example, the oceans. The fact that we have global warming, that there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, this is warming the oceans. It's acidifying the oceans. This is having lots of effects. For example, coral reefs, where a very large percentage of marine species live, are being bleached, in many cases being destroyed. Also, the acidification is affecting the shells of many animals, including mollusks. Mollusks. I know how to spell it, but I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Anyway, and phytoplankton at the base of the food chain. So clearly, carbon dioxide levels are affecting that. But there's a lot of other things going on in the ocean, right? According to one prediction, the oceans will be commercially fished out by 2048, right? 80 to 90% of all the large predator fish are badly threatened. I'll come back to that in a moment. Or maybe an even better, sharper example is plastic, right? Plastic. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there's the great Pacific, what do they call it, garbage patch, plastic patch, huge amounts of plastic, given, you know, they accumulate there because of the way the gyres work with the water circulation. Last year I read about a research team that was examining the ocean floor in some very remote and deep places. What did they find? Plastic particles in every square meter. Often they're absorbed, eaten by the animals who don't necessarily know what's going on, right? And then just a couple of weeks ago, you may also have heard the prediction that by the year 2050, there will be more plastic in the oceans than fish. And we can't blame that on global warming. There's something else going, right? We have had several generations creating plastic, which in most cases does not degrade, or if it does, it's thousands of years. A lot of that plastic is ending up in the oceans. We are changing the chemical composition of the oceans. And that's only one example. You're probably familiar with the fact that we're now at the beginning of an extinction crisis, the sixth great extinction crisis. Species always evolve and disappear, but basically the rate now is about 1,000 times what is natural. The distinguished Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson has predicted that by the end of this century, half of all plant and animal species might be extinct or so weakened that they will become extinct soon thereafter. Please reflect for a moment on what that means for a tradition like ours that emphasizes saving all sentient beings. We seem to be, as a civilization, doing a lot in the opposite direction. In the last few generations, about half of all the world's tropical and temperate forests have been cut down. We're still losing tropical forests at a rate of about 1 acre per second. People like Lester Brown of World Watch Institute, you know, keep trying to remind us or help us to realize, you know, what's happening with topsoil, how much aquifers are being exhausted, which will not be refilled for a very long time, if ever. Anyone else here like honey? The what's it called? The honeybee colony collapse, right? Which is happening in North America and Europe and I think other places as well now. And of course that affects not just those of us who like honey, but if you think about the importance of honeybees for fertilizing so many of our crops, especially I think tree crops. So what's going on here? I think we have an insect that's being saved. Great. Yeah. So how to describe, you know, when we look at the larger pattern, when we look more at the whole of the iceberg, and in a way I think this is just the visible part of the iceberg so far. When we look at this, what can we say? I'm not sure how to describe it, but something like civilization as we know it has sort of taken a wrong turn. And there's a lot we can say about that from a Buddhist perspective, but let me just try to zero in, return to the oceans for a minute, and just focus on one, I think, especially revealing example of what's going on here. And as suits a Zendo, this is from Japan. As you may know, Japanese love sashimi, raw fish. And their favorite is bluefin tuna. But unfortunately, bluefin tuna is one of those very endangered predator species, getting harder to find. The ones that they are capturing tend to be more immature, smaller, and so forth. So this is a huge issue, but one Japanese corporation, Mitsubishi, has come up with a very clever response. Basically what it's done, and I'm not clear if it's sent out its own boats, but basically it's cornered the market. It's bought up all the bluefin tuna that it possibly can and imported them into Tokyo and put them into its massive freezers at 60 degrees below, because their idea is as bluefin tuna becomes more and more commercially extinct, the value of their frozen tuna will go up astronomically. The irony here, of course, is that one of the reasons it's going extinct is because they're doing everything they can to buy up all the bluefin tuna, right? You see the point here. My guess is many of you respond like I do. There's something immoral or obscene about that kind of business practice. And yet, we also have to accept there's a certain kind of business logic to it. In a certain way, it's rational. Maybe very, very profitable. Not only that, but if Mitsubishi didn't do it, well, maybe somebody else would, right? It's the kind of tragedy of the commons. But nonetheless, I think there are a couple really interesting sort of, I don't know how to say it, paradoxes that would be One of them in particular, I think, would be quite humorous if it wasn't also kind of tragic in its own way. You see, what this shows, I think, is the defect or the fundamental problem with any economic system that treats the natural world, that treats the earth, not just our home, but our mother, right? The earth. It treats the earth as a means in a utilitarian way to some other ends, in this case, profit. And when we remember that profit is just another word for money, and when we remember that money in and of itself is a nothing, it becomes quite interesting. What do I mean by this? I mean, money is a nothing in the sense that those dollar bills in your pocket or those numbers in your digital bank account, in and of themselves, they are nothing in that they have no value whatsoever, right? So you can't eat those dollar bills, you can't sleep on them, you can't ride in them, etc., etc. They are literally valueless in themselves, and yet at the same time they're the most valuable thing of all because we as a society define them as value. They are our means of exchange, legally enforced. So we know that we can exchange these little crinkly pieces of paper for almost anything. And there's two implications of this that I think are really, really important. Because we can exchange these worthless pieces of paper for anything, so they're not worthless, they're actually how we define value. Because we can exchange them for almost anything, and because in a kind of unreflective way, we tend to think that the satisfaction of all of our desires is somehow happiness. What in effect happens, I think, is that almost inevitably, money comes to symbolize for us the possibility of happiness, you see. The shorthand being there, it's the way to satisfy all desires, and if the satisfaction of desire is happiness, then money symbolizes happiness. And I think something like that is necessary to understand our kind of collective obsession with money. But that's not the main paradox. That's not the main thing I want to point to. If we remember that money in itself is not wealth, it's only that we can exchange it for something of real value, there's a real amazing irony here. Well, what is real wealth? Well, when you really trace it back to its source, what do we think about? We think about forests. We think about the wealth of the earth, of the biosphere, forests teeming with life, or oceans full of marine life, healthy rivers, healthy air, and so forth. If this is real wealth, if this is real value, whereas money in and of itself is a no-thing, the kind of irony that we're stuck in, I think, is that we are sacrificing, using up everything of real value in order to maximize something that in and of itself has absolutely no value. Do you see? That's what I think Mitsubishi is doing, right? But not just Mitsubishi, I think it's the way that the economic system works. It prioritizes that. Again, everything is treated as a means, everything of real value, of real wealth, the natural resources, or just the flourishing of the biosphere is being used up or sacrificed in order to maximize what? These pieces of paper that in and of themselves have no value. That's kind of weird. But I think that something like that is important to understanding what the root of the crisis is. And as we think about it, if that's the kind of system that we're caught up in, a system of indefinite growth, increase, production, consumption, and so forth, a system that really has to keep expanding and growing and developing if it's not going to collapse, then I think we can also see, given the limits of the biosphere, that the biosphere doesn't develop much at all, that sooner or later, that collective economic project is going to bump up against the limits of the biosphere. And that is called the ecological crisis, right? And that, I think, is the situation that we're in today. Does this make any sense? Am I flogging a dead horse here? I mean, a lot of this, I think we know. I'm just kind of trying to encapsulate it in a certain way, right? Now, shifting more to Buddhism. If this is the situation, where does Buddhism, Zen, but not only Zen, what is there within these traditions that can help us understand and respond to what's going on? I think there are a number of things. Most obviously, people refer to things like interdependence and non-duality, such that, I mean, we can see in a broad sense, our interdependence with the earth means that if we make the earth sick, we're going to become sick in some way. Right? But I'm also thinking particularly about dualities of self and other, right? The way that we tend to separate. Something that we do not just individually, but collectively. We distinguish me inside from other people outside, and also us, or we, as a group separately from other people. And not, and we don't just distinguish in that way, but what goes along with it is that insofar as we understand ourselves to be separate, we can also understand that my well-being or our well-being is separate from your well-being or their well-being, that we can promote our own well-being with indifference or maybe even at the cost of the well-being of somebody else or some other groups, right? And this explains a lot of history, you know. Group selves include men, women. We think we can understand it in racial terms. But also, and I think this is really important given the way that the world is politically structured, it also, I think, applies to the kind of nation-state system that we have. Look, I mean, for the last 400 years, we've had, the world has been organized, well, how? Well, there are 200-plus little gods. And I call them little gods or little deities because each of these nation-states is beholden to nothing higher than itself. And yet, it's also bounded by the borders of other little, big or little nation states around it. And so a lot of the political activity in the last couple hundred years is, you know, what's going to be good for our nation state, and we're not so concerned about what happens to the other nation states. And the reason I'm going on and on about this, because I think the ecological crisis refutes it. In a way, the ecological crisis is saying this way of understanding the world doesn't work anymore, because if China, for example, burns coal, hey, that coal smoke, that carbon, doesn't just stay above China, right? It doesn't just stay above Chinese skies. What happens to it? When Japan has a nuclear meltdown and the water, the radioactive water, seeps into the oceans, it doesn't just stay within Japanese coastal waters, right? What happens? It's going to spread. In other words, it's almost as if the ecological crisis is saying this way of understanding what the world is and how it's organized, you know, we're Americans, we're not Chinese. It's a huge challenge to that. It's almost as if the Earth is saying to us at this particular point in history, given what we've been doing, wake up or get out of the way. Wake up or get out of the way. And that's my sense, that that's the challenge now. It really is. Somehow we're being called upon to wake up to a deeper sense of interdependence. And if we don't, then we're going to not only really damage our civilization, but according to some biologists, there's a very real possibility of human extinction. Again, what can Buddhism offer that can help us understand this? Let me amplify by pointing to one specific example that I think is really revealing. It really helps us understand a lot here. So I want to go back to the earlier teachings, not so much Zen, but go back to Pali Buddhism, where the Buddha emphasizes what's called the three poisons or the three fires. Is that something you're familiar with? Yeah. You know, the Buddha didn't have much to say about evil, but sometimes these three poisons are identified as the sources of evil or the roots of evil. Anybody remember what they are?
Greed,
anger, maybe I prefer ill will there, and third, delusion. Right. And I think this is a really good way to also help us understand what's going on with karma. Sometimes I think we misunderstand the Buddha's point there, because the Buddha emphasized motivation. And basically what I think is going on is that if what the Buddha is saying is something like, when what we do is motivated by the three poisons, greed, ill will, delusion, then problems tend to result, right? Whereas if we're motivated by the opposite, generosity, loving kindness, wisdom, then things tend to go, you know, much more harmoniously and much better. Yeah. But we have a problem, or at least a different situation, that the Buddha didn't have, because we not only have today much more powerful technologies, we also have much more powerful institutions. And the point about these institutions is that some of them take on a life of their own in the sense that they have their own motivations built into them. And I think this is particularly relevant. Well, I think it applies to all third, but the one I want to focus on is the first. What I'm trying to say is that I think we've institutionalized greed into our economic system. We've institutionalized ill will in our militarism. And we've institutionalized delusion in the media. And sometimes I add the educational system there. I don't want to say anything about the second one, and I don't want to say much about the third, except to point out that the media, being mega corporations, are not so much interested in informing or educating us about really what's going on. They are in the business of making money, profit, and they do that with advertising. That is to say, their overriding concern is to find ways to grab our eyeballs and sell them to the highest bidder. But what I want to focus on is the first one, greed, right? And the institutionalization of greed. If we define greed as you never have enough, doesn't that really describe our economic system as well? I mentioned earlier, we do have an economic system that if it doesn't grow, given the way the debt works, if it doesn't keep growing, it tends to collapse, right? But let's be honest, do consumers ever consume enough? Are corporations ever profitable enough? Is their share price ever high enough? Or we can generalize for the whole country, is our GNP, GDP, is it ever big enough? And why is that a weird question? Because we know it can never be enough, right? Is right? It's just built into more and more. But here's the real issue. Why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? I like that line, so I'm going to say it again. Why is more and more always better if it can never be enough? Right? And what's going on here? How can we understand this as a crystallization or an institutionalization of this fundamental motivation that the Buddha focused on? Well, take for example the stock market and look at the two sides of it. On the one hand, there's the investors, on the other side, there's the companies themselves and what they do. Looking first at the investors, I want to go through, by the way, I'm going through this as just to sort of show how we're kind of locked into a system here that, in a way, no one has responsibility for. It just has taken on, as I said, a life of its own. So let's look at it from that angle, starting with the investors. Millions and millions and millions of investors. Why are they investing in the market? Well, you know, in our culture, if you have some extra money, and that's considered a pretty good thing to do, a pretty good place to put it, right? It doesn't mean that they're bad in any way, but the point is investors, of course, they're really interested in return on investment. You do it because it's going to be profitable, right? Either you're going to get dividends or share prices are going to go up. You don't usually do it because you want to have some impact. There are a few exceptions, but they don't really affect the market in any significant way. In many cases, investors have no idea where their money is, where you have things like mutual funds or pension funds and so forth, right? It's just, it's so deeply built into the structure of our lives, right? And of course, this is so much a valued part of American society that really successful investors are kind of cultural heroes, right? Warren Buffett, the sage of Omaha. Do I have that right? Is that his, right? The Oracle. I think he may be having some trouble more recently, but you know, the idea of a culture hero and kind of a magnet for certain like-minded think people, right? Yeah. So on the one hand, there's this anonymate, composite, collective investment with expectation of return. And then you've got in the middle, you've got what I call this black hole of the market. But look at the other side. How is this expectation on the part of countless investors, how does it translate on the other side for the corporations and their need to be profitable? Of course, it's naturally experienced as unremitting, unrelenting pressure that every CEO feels to be profitable, to return, and preferably in the short run, in the next quarterly report, rather than in the distant future, right? Because that's what the investors want, and you've got to keep the investors happy, right? And of course, there's pressure there in order to maximize profitability. If you can externalize some of the costs, right? If you can maybe make money with a mine digging up the gold and you can leave it to somebody else to clean up, or better of all, if you can just somehow get the mining metal and then get out of there and then you leave a mess, but if you don't have to clean it up, well, your profits are higher, right? Externalization, the pressures to externalize those kinds of costs go very deeply into that system. And as we said, if the CEO, if the company isn't able to respond to that expectation of growth and or profitability, it's going to get in trouble. And this is quite apart from any motivations of any of the individuals involved, right? What do I mean by this? Suppose the CEO, let's take this as an example, suppose the CEO of an energy company, ExxonMobil, if you like. Supposing one day he, and I'm going to say he because it's usually a he, right? Suppose he wakes up one morning and he's had some kind of awakening, Buddhist or otherwise, and he realizes that he needs to, that, you know, the world is in real danger and we need to switch to renewables as quickly as possible. He's had this realization. He's concerned about the future that he's leaving for his grandchildren and descendants and all that. But what's going to happen if he tries to change the company in some way that reduces profits? What's going to happen to him? He's out of there quickly, right? Right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Because basically, the fundamental responsibility of the corporation is not to its employees or to its customers or to the environment or the world as a whole. The responsibility is to the shareholders. They own it, right? Right, exactly. So, if that's true for the CEO at the very top of the pyramid, how much more so it's true for everyone else in the company? If they're not maximizing profit, if what they're doing is not working for the profitability, what's going to happen? They are more than likely to lose their job. And this is quite apart from the individual motivations of anyone involved. Every person there may be what we would consider to be a good guy, a good person, good father, good family man, contributes to charity, etc., etc. But it's the nature of the system, the way the system is organized, that they are required to maximize profitability in that way. If they don't, they'll be kicked out, and somebody else is certainly ready and willing to fill their place who will play that role. Do you see this? Do you see the impersonality or the institutionalization of the motivation? Everyone involved is simply doing their job. The president's doing his job. The employees are doing their job. But also you and I, we're playing our role in this system as consumers, as investors, maybe through our pension funds, right, and so forth. Everyone is just doing their job, but as I think James Hansen said, and this is the big, all that we need for an ecological catastrophe is to keep doing what we're doing now. Just keep doing what we're doing now, and things are going to collapse. And what I'm pointing to is this is a very good, a very important part of what we've been doing now, which I think helps to explain what Mitsubishi is doing with their bluefin tuna freezers and lots of other examples we can give. Does this make any sense? Yeah. Now, okay. Where does Buddhism come up here? And I mean, what I've tried to offer so far is a kind of a Buddhist-flavored perspective on the situation. Where does Buddhism come in here as far as helping us respond to this? I think within the Buddhist tradition, we have something extremely important here. And in fact, I wonder if this is maybe even the most important contribution that Buddhism can make to this situation. I'm referring to the Bodhisattva path and a particular understanding of the Bodhisattva path, right? I don't know if you're familiar with the Washington-based eco-dharma group called One Earth Sangha. They've started just in the last year or two, they've started eco-sattva training online. You know, anyone can take it. But the point of that, of course, is that what I think is happening in response to this kind of urgent situation, which is something the world has never faced before and something that Buddhism, too, has never faced before, what this is leading to is a kind of expansion or modification or development of the whole way that the Bodhisattva path has been understood, expanding it in a way that's more concerned about social justice and ecological sustainability. What's really important about the Bodhisattva path is that the Bodhisattva has two practices, or I don't know, is that the right way to say it? A double practice or a practice with two sides to it. On the one hand, he or she continues their involvement with personal transformation, that is to say, personal practice, meditation, for example, that they're still working on themselves. At the same time, they know that that's not sufficient, and they know that that can provide a kind of a grounding or a equanimity or a stability that therefore they can bring into the larger forum or the larger social institutional context in order to address the kinds of things that we've been talking about. Right. Bill McKibben made the really important point that in response to these kinds of challenges, and I think you can see how this is consistent with what I've been trying to say, even if 10 or 12% of us do everything we possibly can to individually reduce our carbon footprint, this, he says, will have almost no impact whatsoever on the way things develop. That's a pretty strong statement, but, you know, 10, 12%, that's not a huge percentage, but it's also a lot more then probably we'll be inclined to do something like that, right? He says that's not going to be enough, but if a part of those people also become politically, socially engaged in actually addressing the system, then it will work. In other words, his point is it's not enough just to transform our own carbon footprint, our own way of living on the earth and try to do more lightly, but we also need to become engaged in ways that obviously make many of us uncomfortable, right? We'd rather just meditate, and the political world is messy. We'd rather not deal with that. But nonetheless, the point is, I think the eco-sattva understands this, and the eco-sattva is not afraid to get up from her cushion and go out in the political fray and get her hands dirty in as far as doing the best she can, trying to address the kind of urgent and unprecedented situation that we're in here today. What I love about the Bodhisattva Ecosattva path is that this double practice, I think, resolves two kinds of problems that occur if we emphasize one at the expense of the other. I think many of us know activists. Maybe we ourselves have been activists out in the fray trying to change things. And we know how difficult that is. We know how frustrating it is, how easy it is to get disappointed, become angry, become burned out. This is sort of par for the course, right? And that's why the personal practice is so important, because someone who has the personal practice in terms of their own development, they have a way of healing themselves, or not just healing, but constantly going back to this place. Well, in Zen we talk about emptiness, right? Realizing this dimension where there's no better and worse, where there's no gain or loss, and yet also not knowing that that dimension, the dimension of form, is emptiness. That it's not enough just to sit there, to cling to emptiness, as we sometimes say, but also emptiness is form, and it's important to be able to act out of that place, to think and feel out of this place, in bringing that into one's ecological or ecosattva activities. So it also, I think, not only helps balance out the problem with activism, but also this tendency that I think many of our Buddhist traditions have to understand the path as simply sort of constantly cultivating emptiness, cultivating equanimity, cultivating peace of mind. And there's a danger there. There's a danger there. There's a danger, and I see it all the time, a danger of overemphasizing form as emptiness and sort of wanting to simply be there, but not acknowledging that emptiness is also form. That emptiness takes form as all this, including form as our endangered, you know, natural world. I can understand how we fall into this problem. I think it's quite natural. We come to Zen or we come to any other kind of Buddhist practice, it's usually a huge sacrifice of time and sometimes money and effort and so forth to, you know, why do we do it? Well, we do it because in some sense we're suffering. Something about our lives isn't working as well as we would like. And so we come to the practice in order to realize that emptiness. And that involves letting go. The early stages of the practice, it's all letting go, letting go, letting go. It's all realizing all forms are empty and so forth. But as the Heart Sutra said, emptiness is form. That we have to be careful. If we overemphasize that, what originally brings us to the practice can actually become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Because leave me alone, I'm working on my own emptiness, my own peace of mind, my own awakening, you know, it can actually reinforce the sense of separation, the sense of ego. It's all about me. I mean, self-preoccupation, Zen practice, Buddhist practice can in fact reinforce that. Whereas the awakening where we let go of ourselves and we realize that we're not separate, we realize what Dogen said, right? Dogen forgot himself. He woke up and he realized that mind is nothing other than rivers and mountains and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars, right? He realized his mind isn't something in here behind the eyes. It's all this. And each of us is simply one of the countless ways in which all this is taking form right here and now, right? So the real awakening involves losing this sense of separation, letting go, feeling our not only interconnectedness, but our deep involvement. Realizing we're not inside, but that we're... What did Nisargadatta say, that great quotation? When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns, right? What's wonderful, one of the wonderful things about that, he shows the relationship between wisdom and love, right? The realization is, hey, I'm not in here. There's no me in here that's separate. And the love is realizing that I'm all this, that I'm all of you, that I'm, and therefore the practice involves living in a way that manifests that realization, and that's called love, that's called compassion. Yeah. And so the issue today, bringing this back to climate change, is what do we do, what do we need to do, what can we do that will respond to the particular kinds of urgent ecological situation we're in. What I'm trying to point to is I think this is a natural challenge and it should be a natural concern for Buddhist practitioners as well. Here, do you chant the four vows, the four bodhisattva vows? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all, something like that. In Japanese, Shujo Muhen Seigan Do. It's very interesting. That's a big commitment, isn't it? I mean, it's not something we're going to achieve very soon. So what's going on there? It's really talking about a kind of reorientation of the meaning of my life. It's more a reorientation of the direction, that my life isn't going to be about self preoccupation, what's in it for me, but turning that around and saying, okay, you know, what can I do to make the world a better place? The reason I mention that is I think this has really important ecological implications, because it's so easy to become so completely frustrated. It's like the problem is so overwhelming, right? Let's be frank. At the very beginning, I talked about the ecological crisis. Did anyone sort of feel, oh my God, you know, this is just too big? It is. It's overwhelming. So the tendency is to tune out and say, oh my God, it's just too big. But hey, somebody who's taken this bodhisattva vow, we're not talking about hope and despair here. We're not talking about pessimism, optimism. We're talking about something deeper here. You know what a pessimist is, do you? Somebody who has had to live with an optimist. I think that captures those, some of the sense of, you know, pessimism, optimism, how each of them sort of reinforces the other. You know, there's a kind of back and I think it's the same with hope and despair. You know, there's a certain way that, you know, we read something horrible in the newspaper. By the way, did you hear that January was the hottest month in world history? Oh, and then February was warmer, and then March. Well, you read that and you say, oh my God, so we start to despair. And then we might read something else, like COP21 was signed, what was it, yesterday or the day before in New York? And we feel, we're talking about something different here. The bodhisattva approach is something different. And I think it incorporates what we sometimes call in Zen, don't know mind. You know, this is very important. Acknowledging that we don't really fully know what's going on now or in the future. We don't really understand what's coming down, and we can't. And that's not a formula for not doing anything, quite the opposite. Have we passed tipping points and maybe humanity is doomed? We don't know. We don't know what's happening, and we don't know what's possible, right? Many of us here grew up and took for granted the Cold War standoff between the United States and the Soviet Union, right? Where nuclear disaster was sort of imminent at any moment, it just would have taken a switch to destroy civilization as we know it. What happened around 1990? Was it 89? Suddenly communism collapsed. Well, no one saw that coming. Not even the CIA, I think, and sort of almost overnight. It turns out the world was different than we thought it was. Same thing with apartheid in South Africa, with the ending of the apartheid. I mean, Nelson Mandela's, one day he's in prison for life, the next day he's the president of South Africa. What's going on here, right? It's like, don't know mind means we don't know what's happening and we don't know what's possible. And the truth is, there's something fundamentally mysterious about the world, which has important implications for how the bodhisattva or the ecosattva lives, right? I remember one of my teachers, Robert Aiken, saying, our task is not to clear up the mystery, but to make the mystery clear. Yeah? You know, it's not as though with this practice or with awakening, suddenly we understand everything. No, it opens us up to this fundamental mystery. And this question is, what is my role, you know, within this mystery? And here's what I think it comes down to. Because of our practice, we can act in the world in a particular kind of way, not knowing if anything we do makes any difference whatsoever. That's the task of the bodhisattva, especially the ecosattva. Not knowing if anything we do makes any difference whatsoever, and that's okay. Because of our practice, and I think that's what makes it possible to act in that way, we can do that. We don't get caught up in despair or hope or pessimism or optimism. That's one of the wonderful things about the practice, where we know the ability to let go of those kinds of conceptualizations, to not to get stuck there. Right? It enables us to act in the world without attachment to results. And that doesn't mean that if you're involved in, say, climate change activity, that doesn't mean that you're not working toward results, of course. But nonetheless, one does the best we can, we do the best we can, even when it doesn't lead to what we hope it does, we're not totally burned out and frustrated, we go back to our cushions and we keep carrying on. It's the difference between a sprint and a long distance race. You know, the sprint, your idea is to get as quickly as you can from here to there, and that's all that matters. 100 meters, right? But if you're running a marathon or an ultra marathon, you can't run it that way, right? What do? Yeah, you're going in a certain direction. You're going this way, you're not going that way. You're going in this direction. But nonetheless, every step has to be whole and complete in itself. Just that. Just this. Tathata. Just this. And that's the kind of long-range, deep commitment that our personal practice enables us to do, you see? Again, does this make any sense? I think this is really, as I said at the beginning, I wonder if this is the most important thing Buddhism has to offer, the double practice. And it's really two sides of the same practice. Because the bodhisattva, you know, when the bodhisattva is acting in the world, it's not that this is a sacrifice of her own personal practice. Oh my goodness, I don't have time to meditate. No. The practice in the world is part of our own personal transformation. It's part of this transformation. It's part of transforming the old self-preoccupied, self-centered habits of what's in it for me. You know, how do we actually embody this new realization of our non-separation from the rest of the world? How do we manifest that? How do we change our deep-rooted habits? It's by engaging in the world. So that's the wonderful thing. Engaging in the world, working for the well-being of the earth, is not just working for the healing of the earth, it's also healing ourselves, you see. Healing ourselves of this what's in it for me attitude, where, you know, my well-being is separate from your well-being. And just as I said about China and Japan, more and more the situation now that we're in is that we're all in it together, all in it together. And what happens to the earth, what happens in the next couple generations, to think that somehow we're going to be okay because of those bags of brown rice in our basement or something, it ain't going to work like that, you know?
Right.
The great Swami Beyondananda, I don't know if you know him, you should, right? I think he put it very well. He said, there's bad news and there's good news. The bad news is civilization as we know it is coming to an end. The good news is civilization as we know it is coming to an end. Yeah? And I think he's right on both counts. How much it's bad news, how much it's good news, you know, we don't know. Maybe we can't know, and we can't know how it's going to unfold. But I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that we have a role to play. And in particular, I think practitioners, Buddhist practitioners, have a role to play as bodhisattvas, integrating these two sides of our practice. And do it again, to say it again, and I think this is the critical line, doing the very best we can, not knowing if anything we do is going to make any difference whatsoever. That's what we're challenging. Like, that's the can we say that's the fundamental koan that we're all faced with today? Hisamatsu, one of the recent Japanese roshis, he said, what do you do when nothing you can do makes any difference whatsoever? That was his koan. When nothing you do can avail. Well, we don't know that. That again, that's part of the mystery that we can't sort out. That's a really important part of the don't knowing. And again, what's wonderful about this practice is we learn to be comfortable. We learn to embrace the don't knowing. That's okay. That's more than okay. That's our world. But within that world, we do the best that we can. Thank you very much. Make yourself comfortable. How are we doing for time? As usual, I've totally lost all sense of it. Anybody? Is there a clock here? Oh my God. I talked too long again. Sorry. In a bit, we can break, and those who want to, we can continue the discussion, maybe over tea. But maybe just a couple of quick things. Any responses, concerns, questions? Please.
So, if you're proposing that things aren't looking so great out there, if you look at economic, energy, kind of the environment, okay? Some would say, maybe led by Dr. McPherson, that we may not have 20 years left as us as a species to live.
Right.
So what do we do? How do we respond to that, given that maybe what we do doesn't matter as Buddhists, so to speak? But still, there is this thing of what happens, well, if I have children and their children, and maybe the human population isn't going to be around 20 years from now. That's not for me, that's what some of these scientists are saying.
I'm familiar with his arguments there, and he points out some really important things. I mean, one very important thing is that we tend to think of ecological change as sort of kind of some kind of natural gradient, right? Things are just going to get warmer and warmer. And one of the things he and other people emphasize is that it doesn't work like that. That you can get some very sudden transformations, right? There was a case, I think 55 million years ago, that he cites, where the human, where the world temperature went up like 10 degrees centigrade within a decade or something like that. It was truly amazing. I mean, things, especially if you get methane releases, very quick methane releases. That one. So there are some concerns there, and I think he's right, but I also believe he doesn't really know for sure, because I don't think anyone knows for sure. There's too many. That's one opinion. When I read what he says and a lot of other people, there's clearly a lot of cause for concern, but he doesn't completely persuade me that he knows. It's a possibility, like many other possibilities. I don't doubt that we as a species are under long or short-term threat, but I go back to what I was saying. I think there's a kind of don't-know quality, that there's a mysteriousness here in terms of how the Earth works. And we have to be careful not to presume that we really understand what our fate is. And it's in that context that I think we are called upon to do the very best we can, not knowing.
Yeah. So it's something like, well, we don't know if we're going to be okay.
Sorry?
That it's something like this, that we don't know if we're going to be okay. So then we keep living in ways of knowing that, well, we don't know if we're going to be okay, but we are going to be okay. But it doesn't make any difference. We just keep doing something, whatever that something is, because it always seems like there's hope. There's something that says, yeah, Guy McPherson's got this, and it's not, it's really, there's some holes in that, or may not be this, and so my hope is that's not going to happen. But, you know, what if it is? What if that does happen? What if it is that way? It's like this whole, to me it's like not really looking at something that could really happen here, and really hoping that things are going to go along as usual. It's just going to keep going. We're on a finite planet. We think we have infinite resources. We're going to keep using those and keep using those and keep using those.
Yeah, that's not what I'm talking about, right? I'm not talking about continuing going in that way. I'm saying we do need to do everything we can to change direction, not knowing whether that'll ever be enough, whatever, however you want to define what enough is. Yeah, so I'm not saying that we... And if you don't have hope, this is the kind of scary thing. If you really have hopelessness, then you might say, okay, what's the point? You know, bring on the whatever your drug of choice is. Let's just space out here and enjoy ourselves while we can. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, I'm saying I think there is a fundamental mysteriousness to this sacred earth such that it's really presumptuous of us to say one way or the other. There's thousands and thousands of climate scientists, you know. Many of them are a lot more concerned than what the IPCC is saying. Many of them are aware of somebody like Gar McPherson. You know, there's a variety of views there, and certainly I'm not a climate scientist, so I'm not someone who is able to do some final determination. I think from a Buddhist perspective, we really need to respect and embody this don't-know mind, doing the very best we can, not knowing if it makes any difference whatsoever. Thank you. You first, sir, and then the lady and this gentleman. So, go ahead.
Just to follow up.
Sure.
What you just said, isn't this really about, hope on the one hand and no hope on the other hand? Aren't they really extreme views, and isn't the important thing to just go on and do our practice without following into views? You just do what you see and what you've
done. Exactly. You know, what I tried to say is that they kind of feed on each other.
Yeah.
Like pessimism, optimism, they feed on each other. That's, you know, our practice is about seeing through that.
Right.
But, and our practice is also, but it's not just leave me alone to meditate. It's also our practice is engaging with a world in crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, but you just do it without falling into either hope or no.
So, without falling into either hope or despair, just
right.
My job is to do what I can. Yes, ma'am.
Paul, one time I was doing a retreat when I was in my 30s in Northern Ontario. And, you know, this was going to be the retreat, the only retreat I'd ever done, and I was going to become enlightened within 2 weeks. So it was really important.
Did it happen?
Well, what happened was, the first cabin, the wood was all wet, so they moved me to a second one that had an oil heater. And at night, I would be so afraid at night alone in the woods. But the mice had babies, and they were in the walls. Mm. And I could hear the mother mouse comforting the little mice. Mm. And it would comfort me, and I'd go to sleep at night. And then my oil heater started on fire. It started leaking oil, and there was fire. So I'm thinking not only of the cabin, and that I'll have nowhere to meditate, but also these little mice will be burned to death. So I ran outside and I started grabbing snowballs. Mm-hmm. It was all icy, and it was only new fallen snow that was barely an inch thick. Mm-hmm. So I'm having to go to gray areas just to get one snowball, and then I go in and I throw it at this raging fire. Mm-hmm. So then the guy who delivers the oil kind of showed up and saw the smoke and everything, and he came running and was helping me, except he's saying, "This isn't going to work. I can't get enough snow. We can't take all of this snow. The whole thing's going to blow up. Come on, let's run." And he starts running, and I just kept doing it. And I put out the fire with snowballs.
I'm sensing this is a metaphor for something really important, folks. I hope you'll write it up.
Well, I mean, ever since that, I firmly, you know, believe in making futile gestures on behalf of compassion. You know, why not? What are you doing anyway?
And the mice survived. And the mice survived. Thank you. I hope you're going to write up that story. That's a wonderful story. Thank you.
And the everybody knows you can't use water to put out an oil fire.
At least it wasn't electrical, right? Yeah. Last comment is yours, sir.
I wanted to thank you for your thought and meditation first and sharing it with us. And also thank you for your story that gave me hope. The story of life on this planet is such geologically that we know that species rise and fall. I'm not sure that the ecological imperative of those species is to rise up into the niche in which they are. Mm. I'm not sure that the trilobites of the dinosaurs had consciousness around their rise and fall. Mm. I think it's unique that human beings, at least some, may have the consciousness of the universe looking back on itself, wondering. Mm.
You know, I don't know what the Buddha would say, but I'm sometimes reminded of, do you know the story of St. Michael's Island? Anybody? Just very briefly, and then we'll finish here. It's one of the Aleutian Islands. During World War II, there was a little communication base put there to help the Pacific fleets and such. And because there was a danger of them being cut off, they also brought over some deer. Think about 20 deer, something like that, in case they needed that for food. Turned out they didn't need it for food. The war was won more quickly than expected. The base was evacuated, but the deer were left. In around 61, 62, people came back to the island, and the deer had multiplied. There were about 6,000 deer at that point. And it wasn't, I don't know how big the island is, but it's not huge, right? But then following that, there was a very severe winter, and also they had sort of reached the limits. So my point is, they came back a year or two later, and all that survived were a very small handful. I think about a dozen were left out of the 6,000. They had basically overpopulated and overeaten their resources, and they then suddenly died. And I sort of think about this, you know, when I think about population explosion, right? I mean, when I was born, the world had 2.5 billion people, which means if I live just a couple more years, the population will have tripled in my life. I mean, this is, what does this mean, you know? And yet, as you say, the difference is we can know what's going on. You know, other animals come into their niches. We've made the whole planet our niche in a way, and we have the possibility because of that. But I really believe it's what I said earlier, that we're at a point where there's kind of a spiritual evolutionary challenge, you know, either we wake up and take this next further step, or our time as a species may be up. And I think, I mean, that's my sense of what's going on from a Buddhist perspective. Yeah. Thank you all very much. Those who want to continue, let's continue the discussion over tea and other things downstairs. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.